This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. The fear of the vaccine apparently seems to be real among some people. The question is whether it's based on any evidence. We thought we'd talk with Kalina Koltai, who is a researcher at the Center for an Informed Public at the University of Washington. She works with people like Kate Starbird, who's been on with us before. You've been researching the sources of vaccine misinformation. So a lot of this is coming from people right here in this country who, for some reason, do not trust the vaccine. And I guess it's your right not to get it if you don't want to, but you probably should base it on accurate information. So what are the prevailing critiques of the vaccine now that you have found?
So all these sort of, anti-vax narratives that we're seeing today in relationship to the COVID vaccine are actually sort of the same narratives we've seen over the past few decades. So, for example, questions about the safety of the vaccine, the efficacy of the vaccine, the necessity of the vaccine, things about how it was developed or how it's distributed, or even things that are very conspiratorial. For example, the link with Bill Gates is not something, gotten a lot of popularity over the past year, but that's something that's been talked about in anti-vax communities on Facebook for years. So, and just to be clear that, if someone is experiencing some sort of like vaccine hesitancy or sort of uneasiness or uncertainty about a vaccine, that's not someone who I would call maybe like anti-vaccine or refusing all vaccines. We've only been living in a pandemic for like almost a year now. I think what I always try to tell people is that, having those hesitations is very natural. There are always going to be misinformation about vaccines, but I always like encourage people to look at like, hey, there's actually all this debunked information. Like you see this anti-vax narrative, has someone actually have a counter narrative to that and kind of look at that information to help guide them on their decision making.
Why does Bill Gates keep turning up in these conspiracies? I don't see how he has the time to do all this stuff.
Well, he has the money to do this stuff, right? I think, when we look at conspiracies, either vaccine-related or non-vaccine-related, conspiracies usually center around the idea of that there is a sort of shadowy elite of people in power, and that there is some sort of this power differential between these elite and us as like the normal people. So when we talk about vaccines and conspiratorial thinking, it's more about the ideas like, people in power, or people who have influence, like potentially like Bill Gates, and government institutions like CDC, or even big pharmaceutical companies are all working in concert because they all have power, they all have money to kind of keep the general public under control and through some means. And so you see multiple conspiracies kind of having those flavors.
Well, if people really feel this way, that the food system is trying to poison us, the global elites are trying to vaccinate us, wide swaths of America are uninhabited, especially when you look west of the Mississippi. Why couldn't, instead of investing all your time worrying about conspiracy theories, buy a chunk of land and farm it for yourself? The option there exists. If you don't trust anybody, there are so many places in America where you could hide out and, start your own little compound. Just don't gather up a weapons cache. That's all I ask.
Yeah. There are people, for example, who do pull their kids out of school, right? So, for most places, getting vaccinated is compulsory to attend school. So the only other option they may see, depending on what state they live in, is to actually homeschool or move to another state. So there are whole movements of people who are relocating or taking those actions, or people who protest. So certainly there are people who are taking deliberate behaviors based on their ideology.
Well, good for them. Is that really what motivates us then? It's the compulsory part then. In other words, they're fine with having vaccines out there, but the idea that the state could compel me to vaccinate my kid, otherwise they won't let me in school, that's what gets people riled up?
Particularly if you look at anti-vax movement prior to the pandemic, I do think that is a major component of it. We saw in California in 2015 with SB 227, in which that bill removed pretty much any exemption except medical exemptions to childhood vaccinations to attend school. There was a whole movement of people who really did not like this idea of not having any exemptions. Most states do have an exemption that if you're able to prove for whatever, like it could be a personal belief, could be religious belief, XYZ, depending on the state, of at least an option to opt out. There's this whole idea of a medical rights and medical freedom movement that's happening. It's the terms that they use, which is really essentially the anti-vax movement just rebranded to be a little bit more appealing, fighting its mandates. And so I think that is where this conversation is really happening. And it's difficult because mandates are not necessarily always the right way. You know, I don't think like we should have like people like, you know, and like sort of there's this big fear of like forced vaccine checkpoints. And I think a lot of that is blown up, particularly with COVID, that like you're going to have these like vaccine passports and things like
that. Well, we got pretty close to that, right? I mean, we had travel bans and there certainly was talk about having proof of vaccination to go places. But here's the thing, just as they have a right not to get vaccinated, my kid has a right not to be infected by your kid at school, right? So how do you answer that? If you want to go unvaccinated, that's fine. But what I won't tolerate is you walking around infecting people. So suppose if you don't want to get vaccinated, at least you wear a mask to protect the rest of us. How about something like that?
Well, what's interesting is prior to this year, wearing the mask was seen as a great alternative. So, for example, a lot of nurses or people who work in the healthcare system, if they didn't want to get the flu shot, they would just have to wear a mask at work. And this was seen actually as a pretty solid alternative to getting the flu shot. And what's interesting is it's actually a study I'm conducting right now is actually how the narrative switched about wearing face masks to prevent disease spread, which we see this huge like anti-mask movement. So it's interesting how it's less about the idea of like the science around it, but more about the idea of like, oh, being controlled and being told what to do.
Well, I'm a believer in as much personal freedom as possible. So if people want to set up schools where the rules are different, no vaccines required, and you can find teachers who will buy into that system, then go ahead and do it. I think where I draw the line is where you want to impose your lifestyle on me. And I think they probably say the same thing, right? So, if we want to go back, we got rid of separate but equal in this country for good reasons. But if there are people who voluntarily want to be separate but equal because of vaccines or for any other thing, you can set up your own private school system. You are free to do that, aren't you? If you're willing to bear the cost and some of the consequences.
I mean, there's certainly one solution, but I think the reality is that those kids are still going to interact with other people, unless you are probably on an island with everyone who doesn't want to vaccinate, and no chance of like visitors coming and visiting. Then that might be a reasonable solution. But even if you are in a very isolated area, people are still going to interact with other people. I think that is a nearly impossible situation to have completely isolated community.
Well, there it is. If we're going to live together, we have to learn how to do it right, don't we?
Absolutely. I mean, we are a community of people, and this is a community issue. It's gone beyond just a personal issue. It affects everyone.
Kalina Koltai is a researcher at the Center for an Informed Public at the University of Washington. Kalina, thanks very much. I appreciate it.
Thanks so much for having me here.
Time now for your daily dose of kindness. Sponsored by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. After the deadly storm swept through Texas, a Houston-area furniture store was packed, but not with shoppers. Jim McInville owns Furniture Gallery, goes by Mattress Mac. When the snow left Texans stranded without power or heat, he opened his doors.
We are more than happy to open this furniture store to serve the community because that's why we exist.
He told Good Morning America how he transformed his store into a makeshift shelter.
The people were freezing in their homes. They had no heat, no electricity, and then compounded the problem with no water. I talked to the mayor on Monday night, said, can we do it Monday night? He said, the roads are too dangerous. And then Tuesday, he said, go ahead and open. And we had almost 1,000 people come in Tuesday, 300 spent the night Tuesday night. Same thing on Wednesday.
He gave the community a home away from home, complete with big comfy beds, cozy couches to curl up
on.
It's
a tough situation, and we try to make it a little easier for them by getting them on a good Tempur-Pedic mattress, making sure they have lots of warm food and lots of camaraderie here.
He didn't stop there, though. He made sure everyone was housed, fed, and even entertained.
We're going almost 18 hours a day feeding these people and making sure they've got things to do. We had face painters out here, balloon artists for the kiddos. So it's a task trying to make sure these people look forward to a better future tomorrow.
And this isn't the first time Mattress Mac has stepped up to help during natural disasters. In 2017, he took people in during Hurricane Harvey, did the same back in 2005 when many fled Louisiana after Hurricane Katrina. He says even during disasters and dark times, there can be a spark of something good.
One of our strengths is when adversity hits, we all tend to come together. We forget about our differences. We focus on our similarities and our commonalities. And that's what's happened in this crisis. As I was walking around last night talking to these people, all races, all colors, all creeds, all ages, they had that American optimism that tomorrow was going to be a better day. So I think we need to not focus on who's to blame for this crisis, but focus on how do we move forward to make Houston and Texas and the United States a better place by coming together and focusing on our similarities and helping each other have a better life.
He also says tough times never last, but tough Texans do, and we'll get through this.
Good for him opening the furniture store. Plus, he got a little product placement in there, too. So why not, right?
Yeah, you want spinal support when you're living through a natural disaster. What a saint with his Tempur-Pedic mattresses. Good for him.
Here is G. Scott. Well, now we know how the Mariners president video got out. Was on the Rotary Club video channel, but it had, I understand, like 2 subscribers until this longtime Mariner fan discovered it and tweeted it.
Yeah, I was reading the name. The Mariners fan name is Eric Hess, was the lifelong Mariners fan that kind of stumbled across the video. Kevin Mather spoke on February 5th to the Bellevue Rotary Club. And I was really thinking about that. So he talked on February 5th. The video was uploaded on February 19th. And I was thinking, like, whenever they got ready to post that to the video. So I would assume Bellevue Rotary Club, they had the video and they were going to post it. At that point, before they posted it, they didn't say, you know, some of these comments aren't really that great. They didn't. They just went on ahead right there and posted it, right? And then I was also thinking about this. I was thinking, we ever notice when somebody tells you something like, hey, Dave, hey, I want to tell you, this other person was talking so bad about you and saying all these things. And then you ever wonder sometimes, you want to ask them, well, why were they so comfortable telling you those things about me? Like, sometimes people know who they are talking to. So I wonder why Kevin Mather was so comfortable talking that way to the Bellevue Rotary Club at that time, and why it is that they took that video and didn't see any problem with that. And if it wasn't for that lifelong Mariners fan, would we have ever known about this? Would somebody from the Bellevue Rotary Club would have said, hey, I don't like what I heard. This is what happened, and I don't like it. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know the
answer
to
that part of the problem. Because in the Seattle Times, that article about the fan is, you know, he was just doing his nightly thing, decompressing after putting the kids to bed, searched the word Mariner in YouTube, and that popped up, and he just was casually listening. And even he, not a journalist, not a reporter, not somebody who breaks news, heard it and went to his wife, I think I have something here, and put it on his Reddit. And that's how it took off. Like, just one guy said, whoa, this is weird. Yeah, you're right. The entire Bellevue Rotary Club who listened to him speak live didn't seem to mind it.
No. And Colleen, I'm glad you bring that up, because it now, as you're talking right there, I think back to December of 2018. In December 2018, the Seattle Times headline reads, lawsuit accuses Mariners management of racial discrimination towards Latin players.
Right.
Director Lorena Martin filed the lawsuit after several Latino players confided in her that felt that they were being discriminated against. That was in 2018. I remember what people, the nasty things that were being said about Lorena Martin during that time. It felt and seems as if nobody believed her. In 2019, in February, Major League Baseball finds no evidence of this occurring. So everybody says, oh, it's all fixed. It's all great. So here we are today, and it's happened. And the part that bothers me is the amount of people that act surprised, the amount of people that act shocked. Now, if he was able to say that to that crowd, how often was he saying that amongst the crowd inside of that organization? Is he the only one that feels that way?
That is a great point, because you're talking to a fairly large audience there, right? And you have, I mean, I'm pretty sure all the, it's just standard procedure to video all those speeches and post them so the people who weren't there can see them. And that's true. He felt completely comfortable.
He felt completely comfortable online. Yeah. I can only imagine. Look, let's be real. I get on there and talk to you guys every single morning. There are things that I say in my own house that I probably can't say on the air because of FCC violations, right? Yes. I can't say some of the things. He said that publicly online. what do you think could be said in confidentiality in some of those rooms? So, and when you start talking about cancer, or you start talking about a problem and you're talking about getting rid of it, yeah, you can get rid of it. But the point is, you have to find out if it spread. I don't know the answer to that question, and I'm sure that that is a question that the Mariners will have to figure out going forward. I will say, I love what the skipper, Scott Service, has had to say about it. I really respect him. I've loved him since he's gotten here, and he has been very consistent from the start since he's been with the Mariners.
G. Scott joins Ursula 9 o'clock on Kai Radio. Thanks, G. Among the issues the legislature is dealing with right now, banning for-profit detention centers, new rules for police officers when they see other cops misbehave, and there's progress on a ban on the use of Native American names on public school mascots. Let's get a roundup. Here is Kyra Radio's Hannah Scott.
For years, there's been a push in Olympia to close the state's private detention centers.
This bill is about the conflict of interest that exists between an organization that is beholden to its stakeholders that demand a profit.
Democratic Representative Lillian Ortiz Self behind the bill that would end these facilities in Washington.
I can't tell you the number of complaints I have heard regarding a for-profit detention center in our state. Complaints of abuse that's ranging from maggots in their food to denying access to health care.
Many of those complaints about the Northwest Detention Center.
This facility has abused the practice of solitary confinement more than any other immigration custom enforcement facility in our country. We have heard reports of disinfectants being used that are considered pesticides by EPS. Up to date, they have been at least 30 documented hunger strikes. Three of them are going on right now. A lady who needed medical attention and was denied, and she was so desperate that she slit her wrist in order to get the medical attention she needed. Detainees laid on the yard, and they formed the letters S-O-S.
Republican Representative Robert Sutherland pushing back.
They're not feeding them breakfast at my facility, Madam Speaker. That's a government facility. They're dying because of lack of proper medical care. And it is not limited to private detention centers. And we need to not have a scapegoat be the private industry detention centers and think that by eliminating them, the problem will be solved, that the problem will become better. It will not.
But
having received a constitutional majority, in Gross House Bill 1090 is declared pass.
It was voted off the House floor. The House also approving the proposal to ban Native American names, symbols, and images from being used as mascots, logos, or team names at most public schools in Washington.
This bill is an important time for us to reach out to the first Washingtonians and say, hello, my neighbor, we want to honor you. Hello, my community member, we want to honor you. Hello, my young child, as you sit in our public schools and private schools, we want to honor you.
Representative Deborah LeCanoff pushing this proposal. But critics, like Representative Brad Klippert, argued.
When we come to the end of the national anthem, those kids, when they sing those last few words, they don't just say, land of the free and home of the brave. They shout it. They shout it with pride. Home of the braves. And so I would say, Mr. Speaker, and many of you know I'm a very emotional person. I'm getting emotional right now. We don't have the name on Kamiokan High School as the Kamiokan High School Braves as a sign of disrespect.
In the Senate, progress on a bill from Democratic Senator Mark Mullett aimed at making sure students get access to the right kind of help from school counselors.
Here as well, but my wife is a teacher in the Issaquah School District, and she'll be the first to admit the important role that counselors play in our schools. They have some of the longest time in school to get their degrees. They have master's degrees. And they have some of the most important roles of actually changing kids' lives. And the bill is fairly simple. It just clarifies that counselors are going to spend at least 80% of their time on being counselors. I think what we've seen is a lot of times they will get pulled in many directions in a school setting. And that could be from proctoring tests to monitoring recess. We acknowledge that's still going to happen because we have left flexibility with this remaining 20%. But we are making sure that 80% of the time they are allowed to focus on what they're best at, which is changing kids' lives by being school counselors.
The Senate also acted on one of the first big police reform bills to come up for a floor vote yesterday, but not without significant pushback.
You have to make sure that these good, honorable, ethical law enforcement officers have the tools they need to stop the bad apples.
Democratic Senator Monka Dingrat behind the proposal that creates a duty to intervene for police officers who witness other cops using excessive force.
So they're not standing around waiting or seeing something happen that they know is wrong, that they're empowered to act.
This proposal also requires officers to report any wrongdoing by another officer to their supervisor, a big issue for Republican Senator Linda Wilson.
I can't imagine with a bill like this what the morale is going to do when they're asked to report on their own comrades out there. They know that they have each other's backs, and it's not that they do bad.
So let's talk more about that, Anna. So a couple of situations. You're trying to arrest a violent suspect. You can't have the cops fighting among themselves while you're trying to do that, right?
No, you can't. And specifically what they're talking about here is the situation with George Floyd, where you saw those other three officers standing around as the officer had for eight minutes and 13 seconds, I think it was, the knee on the neck. So and the other officers did nothing. And that's a situation that they want to avoid. So, but at the same time, if you're going to the super, if you're just a tattletale, essentially, about any kind of wrongdoing and going to the supervisor, my first question when I heard about this bill was, isn't that going to lead to possibly some extremely negative effects amongst the ranks? And, you know, the supporters said no, but we'll see.
Yeah. So have other jurisdictions adopted similar rules?
I do believe that there have been some similar rules adopted since the death of George Floyd, but not prior to. I believe that Minnesota has done this.
I mean, you still have officers who, when they see something wrong, will mention something without being compelled to in law. Is that considered not to be enough anymore?
It's considered not to be enough. And in fact, one of the things that the supporters of this bill said during debate yesterday is, look, that there's hesitancy to do that as, you know, part of the cops boys club, if you will, not necessarily all boys, but you know what I'm saying, and that they just don't. They always have to have each other's back, so they don't do that. So this is the effort, they said, the supporters of this bill, to help cops, because they give them this required path to go ahead and do that and report, because otherwise they may not, because of pressure.
Okay, but then but it could also lead to the fact that instead of just one cop getting punished, you get a second cop getting punished for not reporting the first cop. I mean, wouldn't it be better if it was just a cultural change where, you know, you took the oath really seriously to truly protect the public instead of abusing the public?
I think, you know, there's definitely that argument to be made, and I heard it made yesterday by some critics who said, look, this is a knee-jerk reaction. This is very much like what we see in Seattle, where you react very suddenly because of something that's, you know, protests or whatever that have happened, the death of George Floyd, which was terrible, but we need to take our time and really try to figure out how we're going to do what you just said, Dave, which is change the culture, and many don't believe that this is it.
On the mascots, I thought the guy had a good point. When it comes to the Braves, I'm not familiar with the team, but do they make a distinction between mascots that were intended as ridicule and those that were intended as respectful?
No, not at all. There is no such distinction whatsoever. It's just a full-out ban unless you're on tribal land or somehow. There's a couple of instances where school districts can speak directly to a tribe if they're close enough to them or something like that. But otherwise, it's just across the board ban. And Deborah Lekanoff, who's pushing this bill, talks about being a kid and how disrespectful it was for her. But there's also, I believe, some others in the Native American community who don't think this is necessary, but it's still passed.
Are there tribal schools that use tribal symbols for their teams?
Sure, but that's their right, right? That's their area. So it's not and not in the way. I think Deborah Lekanoff gave an example of being at a game or something where they were like, kill, you know, if you're watching your team beat another team, which is the Chieftains, and the other side is yelling, kill the Chieftains, that kind of thing was what she was upset about.
Well, regardless of what
Among
your mascot
things.
Is, you shouldn't go around saying.
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I want to throw out also that there's still that first, that duty to intervene bill that we talked about, just the first of many of these police reform bills that are moving through the legislature. There's still several more, including police use of force and a qualified immunity limit bill that are expected to come up for some floor votes still in the next couple of weeks.
All right, Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet. You can ring my bell.
This is Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien and Chris Sullivan. And now, why is it so many Americans have two refrigerators? To explain, here's Rachel Bell.
This is one of those topics I would never have even thought about. But then the New York Times comes in and does a very long article about people having second and third fridges. And I found it fascinating because I have never had more than one fridge. So I was shocked to read that around 35 million American households have two refrigerators.
Wow.
And 6 million households have more than two refrigerators. This is nuts. And all of this is according to the Energy Information Administration, which is a federal agency that tracks appliances. So the government is on it. They said there's all kinds of statistics. I'll just go through really fast and then we can talk about it. About 27% of today's urban homes and 40% of rural ones have two fridges. The chance of having two fridges rises with your income. So if you make more than $140,000 a year, you are more likely to have a second fridge. But the thing that was fascinating to me is you would think this has to do with the people in the household, like a bigger family would need more fridges. That is not true. They said the most common household to have at least two fridges only has two occupants in it.
What?
So crazy. They also said that people of color also tend to have second refrigerators in disproportionately high rates. Nearly 20% of Black Americans, 22% of Latinos, 23% of Asian Americans, and a third of Native Americans all responded to the study saying they have more than one refrigerator. They gave an example of a family that their adult children live next door, and there's five people total in these two houses. They have five fridges combined. That is one refrigerator per person. And they say the numbers are only going to get bigger because during the pandemic, people kind of freaked out and panicked, you know, just like everyone was overbuying toilet paper back in March. People were buying an extra fridge or an extra freezer thinking that they had to really stock up. So at one point, freezers, like, you know, the one freezer unit for the garage completely sold out. So people started buying fridges instead.
Yeah, but if what you're preparing for is the end of the world as we know it, the power's going to go out and your refrigerator is just going to be a closet.
Yep, this is true, Dave. This is true. But you know what? That's the American mentality. And growing up, I remember I really wanted to have a second fridge. I remember asking for it because my friends who had second fridges, the second garage fill fridge was always full of junk food that my parents wouldn't buy. So I thought if we had this fridge, it would come with soda and frozen corn dogs, frozen pizza rolls and Lunchables. But if we had a second fridge, it would be full of more dumb, healthy stuff.
So you grew up thinking that refrigerators came pre-stocked with food, huh?
Yeah, apparently so. The second ones, at least.
We had a big freezer in the basement. That's what my dad had. He had this idea that we were going to save by buying meat in bulk. Plus, he liked to go deep sea fishing. So we had all these I think they called them bluefish. Anyway, these giant fish. And so he bought an Amana freezer for the basement. It was a huge hulking thing as they were in those days. When we finally sold the house, we couldn't get it out. We had to take it apart piece by piece. The thing was so big.
Wow. That reminds me of when we had a pet rabbit that got so fat, we couldn't get him out of his cage and we had to take the cage apart.
That's exactly similar. Yes. We didn't have to take the house apart. But
it makes sense to me to have the second fridge if you're a hunter or a fisher, because then, of course, you always have a lot of, you know, meat. But it really is such an American thing, because if you think about the way that a lot of Europeans eat, they still go to the store daily. Yeah. You know, you might go to the market just to get what you need for that meal, or, you know, go to the market for the next couple of days. And Americans are into Costco and bulking up and, you know, not having to go to the store that many times because you've bought so much pre-prepared food. I think that's what it is, because it's either full of, you know, processed pre-packaged foods or meat that was hunted, or, you know, a lot of leftovers that you've frozen so you don't have to cook for a while.
Rachel Bell. Thank you, Rachel.
Thanks, Dave.
I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News.
You can hear us live every morning on 97.3 FM or subscribe to this podcast and you'll never miss the show.